From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The United States is an exceptional nation.
That was then Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton speaking before the American Legion in late August of 2016 about American exceptionalism.
I believe we are still Lincoln's last best hope of Earth. We're still Reagan's shining city on a hill. We're still Robert Kennedy's great, unselfish, compassionate country. And part of what makes America an exceptional nation is that we are also an indispensable nation. In fact, we are the indispensable nation. You may wonder how anyone could disagree. But in fact, my opponent in this race has said very clearly that he thinks American exceptionalism is insulting to the rest of the world.
And in that particular case, Hillary Clinton was telling the truth about Donald Trump.
I don't like the term, I'll be honest with you. And people will say, oh, he's not patriotic. Look, if I'm a Russian, or if I'm a German, or if I'm a person we do business with, why, you know, I don't think it's a very nice term. We're exceptional, you're not. I never liked the term. When I see these politicians get up with the American exceptionalism, and we're dying. We owe $18 trillion in debt. I'd like to make us exceptional because I think you're insulting the world. And you know, Jim, if you're German or if you're from Japan or you're from China, you don't want to have people saying that.
Right.
I never liked the expression.
And it appears President Trump is not the only one that feels that way. Last week, the U.S. Nuclear Posture Review was released, and it contains an interesting statement, a formal admission by the U.S., that the so-called unipolar moment, the period after the end of the Cold War when the U.S. enjoyed unchallenged global dominance, is over. What this might mean for American policy towards the rest of the world was explored in an article in the internet news and policy magazine The Duran by executive editor Alexander Mercuris, who's a lawyer and journalist based in London. We spoke with him via Skype from London Saturday. So, Alex, I'm looking at your columns at theduran.com, the top thing I'm looking at today, Saturday, is U.S. admits, the unipolar moment is over. Just below that, you have disorder that's going on, or actually just above it, the current state of negotiations to form a government in Germany, and we've been, mm-hmm. watching the chaos, basically, that's been taking place since the last elections there. And I'm thinking that this is all context. I mean, it's obviously really the context to this fight that's going on in the United States between, like, the hegemon track that they've been on for a long time, or an acknowledgement of a multipolar world. And that there's a battle going on in the elites both here in the Western Hemisphere and also in Europe over exactly that question. So maybe we could start with a little context and then jump into what's actually going on with the dueling memos at Memogate now.
Well, I think you've put your finger on this. I mean, the key battleground of the Cold War and the key battleground of the new Cold War is Europe. And the most important country in Europe by far is Germany.
Right.
Now, Germany and Russia have a very long relationship. Sometimes they've been at war with each other. Increasingly, however, since the 1960s, there's been a trend for Germany and Russia to work increasingly closely together and to integrate their economies more and more. German industry investing heavily in Russia, building up trade with Russia. What seems to be happening now is that the Germans are finding that the US is not happy with that. That's creating political problems in Germany. And at the same time, because there's been this attempt to sort of break this link between Germany and Russia, that's created an international crisis over areas like the Ukraine. And it has provoked the Russians and the Chinese and all sorts of other people around the world to start taking countermeasures as they feel themselves threatened by the US. And you see a situation simultaneously where the US is now admitting they issued an extraordinary, very interesting document, the Nuclear Posture Review, in which they admitted that their military position is no longer as strong as it used to be, and they're facing what they call great power challenges, and that there's been a return to great power competition. And at the same time, simultaneously with that, and it is not a coincidence, there is a political crisis in Germany with various people, both on the right and on the left. One has to understand that this is not a right-left issue in Germany, saying we have got to start rethinking our foreign policy. Our alignment with the US is not really in Germany's long-term national interests. We've got to start looking at our relations with Russia and China, which are our natural economic partners.
Yeah. You've had, since 1945, for sure, you know, the arrangement that was made at these various places, reneged on much of it by the United States, at Potsdam and Yalta and such, where Germany being the center geographically, more or less, and also economically, certainly, of Europe, the development of Europe into what's become the EU, with the German economy being an engine of that, also a magnet for an awful lot of the wealth of the rest of the continent, unfortunately, for a lot of folks. And also a natural bridge to Russia, to the old Soviet republics. And as the you mentioned, in the 60s, you started to see the German economic activity start moving eastward and engaging there. In the 80s, as the unification deal was being negotiated, you had both a promise from the United States that NATO wouldn't even occupy what was then Eastern Germany, let alone all of the countries up to Russia's border. So you were looking at establishing a zone of peace. That was the expectation there, a demilitarized zone, in essence. Economic, if not integration, certainly a very broad and deep rearrangement of the economic relations with Germany, looking, expecting to be able to develop Russia going forward from the late 80s. And that was thwarted by the United States. And instead, we've had this hegemon model. U.S. sits on top of everything, and we are the exceptional power, and that's that. And Russia to be looted, ultimately. And that is what's been falling now. That model has sort of fallen with the rise of the BRICS, the rise of multilateralism around the world, even here in the Western Hemisphere, you know, the rise of the Bolivarian, movement and all of that. So that's the context for this fight.
I think that's exactly right. I think you got it exactly right. I mean, I think after the end of the Cold War, there was an understanding in the United States that they had this moment when they could basically remodel the international system in the way that they wanted. So what they did was they did everything they possibly could to reduce Russian power to the greatest extent that they could. And they also sought to anchor Germany, which is, as I said, always this potentially pivotal country in Western institutions by expanding NATO eastwards in breach of promises made to the Russians and of building up the EU around Germany, which would in effect tie Germany to the West. It's important to remember that until 1945, Germany was not perceived as part of the West. Right. It was seen as outside the West. It was looked upon not as part of the Atlantic community. But now there was this effort to lock it into the Atlantic community. And that system is breaking down because, of course, what has happened is that the Russians have basically thrown off the shackles that were placed on them in the 90s. The Chinese have developed their economies purposefully, and the Germans are now reviewing their own position, and that's why you have a political crisis in Germany. In a way, the tension that we've seen over the last couple of years between in the international tension with Russia was, I feel, almost the last throw, the last attempt to try to stop these events happening. And if you go back to this review, the extraordinary thing that is in it, this Nuclear Posture Review I was talking about, is its extraordinary pessimism. It is a recognition by the United States that that moment after 1991 has passed and that its attempt to reorder the international system around itself has failed.
With that gloomy outlook from that perspective, they also bring, of course, some rather gloomy plans to for quote-unquote defense under those conditions, which...
Well, indeed, sir. I mean, if I can just talk about that briefly. Yeah. I mean, well, one of the things that's very interesting about this document is that now the focus is actually trying to defend the position of the United States as the major great power. So whereas in the 1990s it was to expand the U.S., now, and to globalize the world, if you like, around the U.S., now it is to defend the very extended commitments that the U.S. took on itself in the 1990s.
Right.
And the way they're going to do that is by doubling down on their already vast nuclear arsenal. They're going to expand it even further. Right. And there's even talk now, very dangerous talk, about producing low-yield nuclear weapons, which are straightforwardly a way to threaten other countries with limited nuclear war.
Right.
And it's a very, very disturbing development indeed.
Yeah, and you know, this is kind of the yin and yang of the PNAC document, by the way, that we're talking about. We had on the one hand, looking at that unipolar moment, that yes, we should have this, we should fill this space to the fullest, and on the other hand, we should smother anything that tries to rise as a competitor. And now that they've seen the rise and they're admitting to it, their natural response is to try to smother it, try to contain it, and try to preserve that moment as long as possible of hegemony.
Exactly. Even though, and this is the other thing, if you read the document very carefully, as I said, it's very pessimistic.
Yeah.
There is an understanding buried within it that the United States can only buy itself some time. It can't resist these forces indefinitely. But when you're already looking at military build-ups, nuclear weapons build-ups, low-yield nuclear weapons, one has to be very concerned that rather than simply accept the changes in the international system that are happening and accommodate itself to them, the United States is not only going to try and extend that period, it's going to resist every change, and that, of course, hugely increases the danger of war.
And to me, this is, you know, I've been taking heat from people trying to point this out over the last year and a half, but the tagging of Trump in this Russiagate thing with Russia, as opposed to tagging him with racism, Islamophobia, whatever else, all the things that they throw at him, but it's not the central narrative, and it's not the thing that's being pursued criminally, and it's not the thing that they're dragging people out of the White House and putting them before the dock over. That's Russia, Russia, Russia. And the thing that, you know, that's very telling, because that's the thing that finds expression in policy. And that policy coincides exactly with these contextual things that we're describing, with Trump on one side having said, wouldn't it be nice to have decent relations with Russia? Gee, maybe NATO is obsolete. No more regime change, whether he meant it or not. These are things that were never even said publicly in the United States since Reagan. And on the other side, really rabid stuff, advocating war, advocating pushing sanctions to the point where they would provoke war, all of that. And people are choosing up sides towards war with Russia.
Well, I don't think it's a coincidence that just as the time when we're seeing a political crisis in Germany, we're seeing a political crisis in the United States, with Russia being, let's be very clear about this, at the focus of both.
Right.
Because what has happened? I mean, I agree with you, by the way. I don't know to what extent Donald Trump really, genuinely, sincerely meant any of the things that he said.
Right.
But to the extent that he said them, what they seem to have done is provoke a kind of nervous breakdown within the American power system, which is utterly horrified that this rank heresy was being uttered. And that's why other things that Trump does, which are to put it mildly, disturbing. I mean, you've talked about his racist immigration policies, right. His inflammatory rhetoric, his extraordinary economic policies. Those are not the focus, because, I mean, the idea now is of a president who's saying, well, look, let's not resist these changes in the international system. Let's find a way to accommodate ourselves to them. Right. Let's see what we can do to all of that. Now, as I said, whether he believed it or not, I don't know.
Right.
But that is not what the Nuclear Posture Review is saying. And I don't think it's what people within the Pentagon, the CIA, the State Department, the Wall Street complex, all those people, that's not what they wanted to hear at all. Yeah. So we've had this extraordinary crisis over this last year in the United States based around this very bizarre and fake scandal. But always the thread is Russia.
Yep, that's right. All right. So with that context, let's take a look at these things. First, we have, aside from the hearings and the, Saturday Night Live skits and the editorials in the Washington Post and the New York Times, if you can call an article on the front page that doesn't say it's an editorial, because it looks like a news article, but acts like an editorial, with all of that going on, you've had actually in the last week and a half some material things. First, the Nunes memo being issued, then a leak of the criminal complaint that was referred by two Republican senators, Grassley and Graham, to the Department of Justice and the FBI, saying we want an investigation of Christopher Steele for violation of 18 U.S. Code 1001, which is false statements, which is exactly the statute that they had Mike Flynn plead out to. And they produce 8 pages, essentially, of evidence in a memo under the referral letter that looks like a prima facie case. And now we have also the 10-page rebuttal from the Democrats that went to Trump, and then Trump, I guess, said, well, some of the things were planted in here that I'd have to reject it because they're clearly violations of blah, blah, blah. So they're dickering around with that. And then finally, we had Nunes yesterday or Wednesday, I don't recall, Friday or Thursday, saying, you know what, I think I'm calling for them to release the entire FISA applications because this is something that is of such critical public importance. And so we may end up seeing the actual, all these people are dickering about this is what happened. We may actually see the primary materials, and it may come to a head, this whole Russiagate, within the next few days or next week.
Well, I think you've described the partisan battles very well. And can I just make a quick observation about that? One of the things that confuses a lot of people about this is that, of course, there are no good guys in it. I mean, when people say that the Republicans are in it for themselves, they are absolutely right. It's not that Nunes and co. Are particularly bothered about the FBI spying on people, but they don't like it when the FBI spies on their own side. Having said that, and I think that's true, I think we mustn't get lost with that, because nonetheless, whatever Nunes's own motives are, what he is revealing is extremely disturbing indeed. Yeah. And there's three things to take away from this. Firstly, the story about Russian interference in the election is frankly nonsense. The story about the Trump campaign and Donald Trump colluding with Russia to steal the election is nonsense. The fact about the FBI and the US intelligence community spying on people who were involved in the election on the side of Donald Trump, who said that he wanted better relations with Russia, that is true. It is also true that it was based on evidence, a manufactured dossier, which is, one, paid for by Hillary Clinton and her people, and two, and this is perhaps much more important, simply not true. And when they used this thing to get all those surveillance warrants, they hadn't the information to make them believe that it was true.
That's right.
So it is the surveillance that is the real scandal in this, not the collusion. That's nonsense. Not the Russian meddling.
Right.
That is nonsense. Right. It is the surveillance, which, frankly, looks like it was done illegally.
Right. And then let's take a look at that, because what happens next with the surveillance is there's unmasking and leaking in massive scale. So what you have, a fake dossier to induce essentially a private use of FISA to the benefit of the Clinton campaign for gathering the information, and then a weaponizing of that information and a targeting of first Trump the candidate, then Trump the president-elect, with this rolling coup that they were trying to manage with the Electoral College and with the certification of the vote in the joint session in January and all of that, and then just beating them up continuously, turning the staff against each other and all these other things with this weaponized information has made it impossible for him to govern.
Absolutely. And let us not forget that the official who was most identified with his policy of rapprochement with Russia, Michael Flynn,
right,
was brought down by the leaking,
right,
illegally, of classified information,
that's
which
right,
is not something, I think, which people seem to have grasped either.
That's right.
And we come back to the first points that we made in our discussion. Why is this all happening? It is because Donald Trump, strange, bizarre, in many ways unattractive, ugly man maybe, that he is, nonetheless suggested, whether he believed it or not, that he has, that the United States should seek some sort of a rapprochement with Russia.
Right.
And I have no doubt that that is the underlying cause of this whole extraordinary, bizarre campaign, why there was this determination to try and do everything possible to help Hillary Clinton become president, why there was an attempt to discredit Trump by throwing this Russia collusion allegation at him, why his officials were spied on, why, as I suspect we're going to find out, some of his own conversations were probably picked up over the course of that spying, why there was this media campaign organized against him, and why all his officials were unmasked in the way that they were. And if one cares about civil rights, about democracy,
right,
about the rule
right
of law, about all of those things, one should care about these things that were done, irrespective
yep
of what one feels about Donald Trump, the person, and his administration.
Yep, I agree with that. And you know, and that's the thing. I guess when you have someone that is so unattractive, no one wants to step up and defend, you know, be perceived of as defending that person rather than defending the things you just described. And there's something else that's really relevant here, and that is, you know, people look at this as if it's, you know, you have to choose up sides based on how you feel about Russia. And it isn't Russia or even the rapprochement per se with Russia that is the threat represented here by Trump, but rather the acknowledgement in policy of a multipolar world. In other words, the United States stopping the expense of trillions of dollars trying to become again hegemon, and instead engaging the world as a partner in all of the tasks that lie ahead of us. Half the people of the world have no water systems or sewer systems or schools or housing or hospitals or whatever. There's an opportunity for a lot of people to make a lot of money finishing the job of developing the world. And if they did that peacefully, we'd all be a hell of a lot better off. And that's the policy that's being fought.
Well, indeed, it is the policy that is being fought. And I would also say something else, which is that, of course, pursuing this hegemon policy, as you correctly describe it, is now having a very, very bad results within the United States itself, because we see all the machinery that's used to try and influence things all over the world, because the United States has been involved in regime changes and coups and plots in all sorts of countries. They're now being brought back to the United States, and they've been used to try to influence political processes there in a wholly illegal way.
Right.
And that, again, should be a major source of concern to people. And I think they should ask themselves, if they really care about the fate of the United States and the fate of the American people, Is that the sort of country we want to be? Do we want to be this this country that's always under arms, where our own intelligence services and our own security services run amok, where people are monitored and surveyed during elections, and where attempts are made to push those elections in the direction of particular candidates who will support, if you like, the power complex as it pursues its international hegemonic policies? I think that this is a discussion, a conversation America urgently needs to have with itself.
Yeah, I agree with that. Finally, I'm curious, you know, you've witnessed up close the manifestation of the same, you know, struggle more or less in the UK, which sort of really sat deeply into the Brexit referendum. It was 2 years ago now, 3 years ago. It was kind of a precursor. It was kind of a precursor to the 2016 election here, with, you know, there's a, and some of the same questions, you know, when Trump talks about America first, people think of it in terms of, you know, as against some Marxist absolute, that this is nationalism and that that's retrograde and reactionary. But when you talk about America first instead of America only, then, you know, you're talking about a different animal. And it's the same with the question of Brexit, for example. You know, on the one hand, people are saying, well, you're against internationalism and, you know, the reduction of nationalist barriers and all of this stuff, and therefore that's reactionary. But the question for a lot of people, and people on the left in particular, was that, you know, we've lost our sovereignty to corporations who rule through these little, you know, fiefdoms that are created in these extra or supranational structures without, they're not democratic structures. So what's it look like, you know, I mean, the U.S. battle kind of mirrors that. What's the landscape look like in the U.K. in the aftermath of the Brexit vote, regardless of what's happening with Brexit?
I think, first of all, I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think people who conflate the cause of internationalism with that of the EU need to be extremely careful, because really, to my mind, they're not the same thing at all. Right. Now, in Britain, what we are seeing is not just a rebellion against the EU, but a rebellion against certain neoliberal economic and social policies that which were actually pioneered in Britain. Britain was the precursor in the 1980s with the Thatcher government with lots and lots of these policies. So we're seeing a rejection of them amongst lots of people in Britain, a rise, if you will, of a new movement within the Labour Party, which has alarmed many people within the British establishment, which is challenging that. And we've seen a Brexit vote, which was also part of that challenge. And we talked about a political crisis in Germany. We've talked about a political crisis in the United States. There is also a political crisis in Britain, because Britain has played a key role in the Cold War, both the old Cold War and the new.
Yeah, you know, and I'm just on that note, some parting shot. It seems that from here, looking at it, that Brexit, rather than, say, Boris Johnson or some other, you know, person involved in that, was Britain's Trump, and Corbyn, say, Britain's Sanders and or Trump rolled into one, where you have, in essence, a workers' revolt against some of these, the architecture of neoliberalism.
I think there's a major difference between Corbyn and Sanders, in that I think that Corbyn is most definitely not part of the British political establishment as it used to exist.
Right.
Whereas I think Sanders basically is, and I think that is a fundamental difference.
Yeah.
So Corbyn is what is called in Russia sometimes a non-system politician.
Yeah.
He has been consistently opposed to the whole history of international interference in other countries, the wars, the regime change. He's always opposed it. He's always insisted upon social and economic changes within Britain. Now, whether he's going to be allowed to do these things or going to be able to do these things in Britain, who knows?
Right.
But the very fact that he is rising in the way that he is a sign that many people in Britain are now rebelling against the system that was imposed upon them. And that, I think, is a very, very positive thing.
Okay, Alexander, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.